Genealogy by Tim, Season 4, Episode 3, recorded March 30th, 2024. I'll give an overview of the current state of some of my projects this month, including the MUMMA transcription project, my efforts to receive birth records from the State Archive of Mykolaiv Oblast, and my efforts to discover the Hogendobler Family Bible, which was allegedly published in 1522. But the big story this month, ancestor spotlight on Harriet Harrison Polag, who died on this date 80 years ago, March 30th, 1944. She had a pretty interesting life, and I'll tell you all about it this month on Genealogy by Tim. Let's cover some old business here first. The MUMMA transcription project is now reaching into its second year. I remember a year ago working on this project, transcribing names from the MUMMA.org website into my family tree software. I didn't realize then how long this project would take, but it's nearing its conclusion, probably about a couple months away. But I remember a year ago, spring break, entering names from MUMMA.org into my family tree software. And then, at the end of spring break, my classroom was being painted, and I was displaced into the computer lab and didn't get much teaching done, so I let the kids use the computers in the computer lab while I pecked away on my computer, still entering names into my family history database. That was a year ago, and today, March 30th, 2024, I get to report I'm down to my last line, entering names from MUMMA.org into my family tree. I just wrapped up and posted to my website the line of Christian MUMMA. Christian MUMMA is a grandson of Peter MUMMA. Peter MUMMA is my original colonial immigrant ancestor who arrived in this country in 1748. He had several children, among them Peter Jr., from whom I've descended. And an older sibling of Peter Jr.'s was Johannes. And Johannes is the last child whose descendants I've been entering. Johannes had several children. One of them was Christian, and I've been working on his descendants over the past 2 months. And I just wrapped up that line, and I'll move on to the last line, Jacob MUMMA. Jacob B. MUMMA was born February 13th, 1801, in Hempfield, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, United States. He died November 19th, 1889, and is buried in Newtown United Methodist Cemetery in Newtown, Rafo County, Rafo Township, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He had several children, many of whom moved out to the Ohio area, not far from where my uncle currently lives in Clark County. And the hope is that I get this line completed before I visit my uncle this summer, and perhaps we can do some family history research together. The line is about as long as the line of Christian MUMMA, so it should take me another 2 months at least to enter this information. But it should be done by the next GEDCOM update to my website this summer. And then that project will be done, and I can go back to doing ordinary research. And many thanks, of course, as always, goes out to Doug MUMMA, who maintains the MUMMA.org website. The information is extensive and invaluable. And I'd like to wish a belated happy 90th birthday to Joan MUMMA. She doesn't know me, but I've seen pictures and video clips of her 90th birthday party, which have been posted at MUMMA.org. She doesn't know me, but I'm a huge fan of the MUMMAs, Doug and Joan, and their awesome website. In other old business, a pair of projects that I've been working on recently seem to have stalled out, at least temporarily. The first is retrieving birth records for Louis Anflick, who was born in 1876, from the State Archives of Mykolaiv Oblast in Ukraine. I initially had some success contacting the archive and using ChatGPT to translate my request from English to Ukrainian. The archivists apparently found the document and sent me an invoice. And this is where things get tricky. I've had trouble paying this invoice. And the irony is the invoice is for $1.09. But I have not been able to get this thing paid. And I've tried opening an account at Wells Fargo in order to wire money to Ukraine, only to have that money returned without explanation. And it's been quite some time since the archivists have responded to an email. The hope is that they'll respond as soon as a payment actually goes through and is recognized. But when I send emails explaining, hey, I've attempted to send money, I see that it's been returned, I don't get any response from them saying, oh, okay, that's okay, we'll wait. They just don't respond, so it makes me wonder if, you know, maybe things aren't all well there, or maybe they forgot about me, or maybe they're annoyed with me at this point. Last week, I went to a financial institution here in Jenkintown known as the Ukrainian Self-Reliance Federal Credit Union with the hopes that they would be able to help me send this money. And the representative was not completely forthcoming with assistance. She recommended sending through an American institution, which I've already done, but also said it may be possible to pay this invoice, but it requires several steps. They got to contact someone, and someone has to contact them back, and they have to come to some sort of understanding, and then they can get the thing paid, and I would have to be a member of the Ukrainian Self-Reliance Federal Credit Union to make that happen. And I'd have to check and see if I'm eligible for membership, and it would be a big hassle. I may try again at Wells Fargo. For an increased fee, I can have a representative send the wire transfer for me, and that person is probably more knowledgeable than I am. Perhaps I did it incorrectly online, and that's why the money was returned. The trouble is, it cost me $25 to attempt to send the money online, and it cost, I believe, $35 to come into a branch and have a representative do it. So these attempts are costly. Now, if the payment does go through, then I could say, well, hey, maybe it was worth the effort, it was a learning process, but I can't keep making $25 attempts to pay a $1 invoice. So eventually I'll break down. If I don't find success pretty soon, I'll break down and hire a legacy tree genealogist to handle this for me. I'll admit defeat and let the professionals handle it. But I'm still trying, and hopefully we'll find some success in the near future on that front. Back in Lancaster, I have another kind of subplot brewing down there. You may remember, several podcast episodes ago, I discovered the existence of the Hogendobler Family Bible, which was in the hands of a Dr. I.L. Moyer in 1937. This family Bible was transcribed as part of the Daughters of the American Revolution application of Mrs. Mary Wilson Masters. The question I have is, what happened to this Bible upon the passing of Dr. I.L. Moyer back in 1957? And I emailed the Lancaster County Historical Society, also known as LancasterHistory.org, to see if they happened to know what happened to this very historic document, allegedly published in 1522. And they did not have it among their collection. They checked the collection of the Lancaster Mennonite Historical Society, now known as Mennonite Life, and did not find the Bible among those collections. They did refer me to the Columbia Historic Preservation Society at columbiahistory.org. I've never heard of them, but if they've come recommended by Lancaster History, then, you know, I'll go ahead and ask. The next place I'll look is the estate records of Dr. I.L. Moyer, if the Bible is mentioned there. That would be either at the Lancaster County Archives or the Lancaster County Register of Wills. Those are the next steps in this research, but no immediate satisfaction at Lancaster History in search of this ancient family Bible, the Hogendobler family, published in 1522 and brought to this country by Nicholas Hogendobler in 1750. For our headlining event this month, I'd like to do Ancestor Spotlight on Harriet Elizabeth Harrison Polag. My family history software reports that she was my second great-grand-aunt. She was the grand-aunt of my paternal grandmother, Joan Harrison Graham. She was the sister of my grandmother's grandfather. My grandmother's grandfather was William Pickersgill Harrison Jr. He was born in 1874 and died in 1926. Harriet was born March 12, 1878, and died on this date 80 years ago, on March 30th, 1944. She had a number of life experiences that made her a very interesting person, so I'd like to do a spotlight on her today. Harriet's interesting life began the day she was born. She was born March 12, 1878, and had a sister, Ellen, who was also born March 12, 1878. That's right, she had a twin sister. And it's been an interesting family history question for me whether Harriet and her sister Ellen were identical or fraternal twins. This mystery came about halfway towards being solved back in June of 2022 when I discovered a photograph of Harriet on the Paulson family tree, which is a public tree on Ancestry.com. That tree includes photographs of Harriet's daughter Claire and Claire's husband William Paulson. So if I can find a photograph of Ellen, that could determine once and for all whether the two were identical or fraternal twins. When Ellen grew up, she married a man named George A.M. Frame, and they lived in the Camden County area of New Jersey. I believe some of her descendants are contactable with contact information available at yp.com. That's the Yellow Pages website. So if I make a few contacts, I should be able to come up with a photograph of Ellen. I can compare that to the photograph that I have of Harriet and see if they were indeed identical or fraternal. For Harriet's 21st birthday on the 12th of March, 1899, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that a surprise party was tendered to Miss Hattie Harrison on her birthday, March 13th, at her home, 4907 Girard Avenue. The guests were Mr. George Rublack, Miss Maggie Doherty, Mr. William Stacy, Miss Jenny Dalrymple, Mr. Chester Seymour, Miss Nettie Hoft, Mr. William Walters, Miss Katie Schmidt, Mr. Edward Johnson, Miss Bessie Flanagan, Mr. Frank Nordell, Miss Ellen Harrison, that would be her sister, Mr. John Farrell, Miss Sally Harrison, that would be another sister, and Mr. Frank Berry. Frank Berry, I believe, was a cousin, and the Berries were a subject of a podcast episode back in season 2. So we have a lot of names here that could be a part of the fan club, fan being an acronym for friends, associates, and neighbors. These would all be very interesting people to research. Now, I'm not sure how much time I would dedicate to researching each of these names, but there's a lot of people there in that fan club who attended this surprise party for Hattie's 21st birthday. The birthday was March 12th, 1899, and the party was held on the 13th, according to this clipping from the Philadelphia Inquirer. And it bears mentioning that I discovered this article on the surprise party by entering the address, 4907 Girard Avenue. The name was apparently not scanned correctly. The optical character recognition didn't quite pick up the name Hattie Harrison, but it did pick up the address. So if you're searching for information in online newspapers, try not just the name, but also the address and other identifying information you can find on those ancestors. Hattie's interesting life continued with the birth of her first son on the 30th of August, 1909. Her first son was named Joseph Harrison. She did not give her son her father's name. Apparently, they weren't married. The father's name, as identified on the birth certificate, was Lester Ferris. Mr. Ferris is a native of Dover, Delaware. And I can read to you a bit about him from his obituary from the Chestertown Transcript, 30th of January, 1942. His obituary reads, "Funeral services for Lester Ferris, aged 59 years, were held at the home of his aunt, Mrs. Charles Ferris of Dover, Delaware, Monday afternoon with Reverend Harmon Dillard, pastor of Grace Methodist Church, officiating. Interment was made in Lakeside Cemetery. Mr. Ferris died Friday at the Kent General Hospital in Dover following a brief illness from complications. Mr. Ferris was well known in Chestertown, having been a frequent visitor at the home of Mrs. Charles Reed, a relative. The deceased, in his younger days, was well known as a dancer and comedian, playing on the Key Theater and Vaudeville Circuit. He also played several engagements here at the old Lyceum Theater. So he was a performer and a comedian. Would have been nice to have him as a relative, it seems, but I don't believe that that relationship was legitimate. Now, whether it was consensual or not, I don't really have all the details. Whether she really loved him and it was like a Romeo and Juliet situation, or if he was just kind of a guy who took advantage of her, I really don't know. I don't want to say anything to tarnish anyone's reputation, but fact of the matter is, he and Hattie conceived a child sometime around New Year's, 1909, and Hattie chose not to give her son Joseph the name Ferris. So Lester was out of the picture by the time Joseph was born in August. It wasn't until 1914 that Harriet married the man that she would stay with for the rest of his life, which turned out not to be very long. She married Herman Polag on February 21st, 1914. And from that union, two children were born, Martha R. and Claire Polag. After the marriage, Joseph Harrison took the name of his stepfather and he became Joseph Harrison Polag. So Harriet had three children total, the first from Lester Ferris and the second two from Herman Polag. Herman Polag was a German national. He seems to have come to America sometime around 1893 and was a resident alien, as far as I know, for the rest of his time here in America. And that presented a very interesting situation for Harriet. Here's a fact that I don't believe is very widely known today among the American public, but comes up every now and then for historians and genealogists, is that in the early part of the 20th century, American women who married foreign nationals lost their American citizenship. And if they wanted to get their citizenship back, they would have to go through the citizenship process. And this indeed happened to Harriet, and she is listed in the 1920 census as an alien, despite having been born in America in 1878. So I'm going to read to you a short article, and this is coming from the Denver Law Review and is posted up at digitalcommons.du.edu. And this is the law surrounding this interesting chapter of American history. And this is an article called "The Resumption of Citizenship Lost by Marriage to Aliens" by Kazuyoshi Akita. This article was published in the February 1952 edition of the Denver Law Review. And it reads, increased restrictions upon aliens and the possibility of another war have created a strong desire among many former citizens of the United States to regain their lost citizenship. Among this group are those who lost their citizenship by reason of their marriage to aliens. It is with the problem of these women in their effort to regain their lost citizenship that this article will deal. The American courts have followed three different and conflicting common law views as to the effect upon citizenship of women, American women, who married aliens prior to 1907. The first of these three rules is that an American woman did not lose her citizenship solely because of a marriage to an alien, but that withdrawing from the United States or going to and remaining in the foreign country of which the husband was a citizen might operate as a renunciation of the American citizenship of the wife. The second view is that the marriage to the alien was sufficient to cause the loss of the wife's American citizenship, even though residence and domicile was continued in the United States. The third position is that the wife did not lose her citizenship either through the marriage to the alien or by the residence and domicile abroad. The majority of courts have followed the first rule, but the second view has been favored by a number of the courts. The third position has had little following. So, as a little introduction to the issue, prior to 1907, courts were conflicted about what happened to women who married aliens. Many courts said that, well, if a woman marries an alien and then leaves the country, we can assume that she renounced her American citizenship. A lot of courts said, well, no, if she stays in the United States, we assume she intends to remain a citizen. Now comes the Expatriation Act of March 2, 1907. Akita continues. Congress, however, in enacting the Expatriation Act of March 2, 1907, which was the first statute dealing with this matter, took the second view. The statute expressly provided that all women who married aliens took the nationality of their husbands and thereby lost their American citizenship. Provisions, however, were made for the resumption of citizenship at the termination of the marriage. And then Akita goes into some detail clarifying exactly what is meant by the terms all women and what is meant by termination. But the general rule has been established. Starting in 1907, if an American woman married an alien, that woman lost her citizenship. And this continued until the Cable Act of September 22, 1922. So Harriet's marriage was right in that window between 1907 and 1922, when women lost their citizenship if they married an alien. Akita's article continues. The Expatriation Act of March 2, 1907, continued in existence until September 22, 1922, when it was repealed and replaced by the Cable Act. The Cable Act specifically provided that American women no longer lost their citizenship by marrying aliens who were eligible for citizenship unless they made a formal renunciation of their citizenship before a court having naturalization jurisdiction. However, those who married aliens ineligible to citizenship still lost their citizenship. The act further provided that women who married aliens eligible to citizenship would be presumed to have expatriated themselves by living continuously for 2 years in the country of which their husbands were subjects or citizens, or by living continuously for 5 years outside the United States. Women who had lost their citizenship by marriage to aliens and whose marriages had terminated could no longer resume their citizenship under the simple procedure of the Act of March 2, 1907. All of these women now had to be naturalized and termination of their marriage was not required. This privilege, however, was accorded only to those women who had married aliens who were eligible to become citizens and not to those who had married aliens who were ineligible to become citizens. No certificate of arrival in the United States was required if they had not resided outside the United States during the continuance of their marriages. The act was not to be retroactive, and it did not restore citizenship lost by marriage to eligible aliens prior to September 22, 1922. And then the article goes into some detail about which aliens were eligible and which were ineligible. But we had an alteration of the rule of 1907. Now, a woman did not lose her citizenship by marrying an alien who was eligible for citizenship. Because it may have been foreseen that the alien would become naturalized and then the two would live as a pair of American citizens. But if the woman married an alien who was ineligible for citizenship, that woman still lost her citizenship. And this was the rule until the act of March 3rd, 1931. Akita continues in the article. By the act of March 3rd, 1931, Congress amended Section 3 and repealed Section 5 of the Cable Act. Section 3 was amended to read as follows. A woman citizen of the United States shall not cease to be a citizen of the United States by reason of her marriage after this section as amended takes effect, unless she makes a formal renunciation of her citizenship before a court having jurisdiction over naturalization of aliens. The portion dealing with marriages to ineligible aliens was deleted. Thus, it was now possible for American women to marry any and all aliens without losing their citizenship. The act also provided that women who had lost their citizenship by residence abroad after marrying aliens, and those who had lost their citizenship by marrying ineligible aliens could regain their citizenship by naturalization. However, the privilege did not extend to those women whose citizenship had originated solely by reason of marriage to citizens of the United States or by reason of their husbands acquiring United States citizenship. By the act of June 5, 1936, native-born women who had lost their citizenship solely by marriage to aliens prior to September 22, 1922, and whose marriage had terminated, could resume their citizenship by taking an oath of allegiance. The oath could be taken before a court having naturalization jurisdiction at any place in the United States or at any place under the jurisdiction of the United States. If outside the jurisdiction of the United States, the oath could be taken before a secretary of embassy or legation or before a consular officer. In 1940, Congress amended the Act of June 25, 1936. Under the amendment, not only women whose marriages had been terminated, but also whose marriages had not been terminated, but who lived continuously in the United States since their marriages, were allowed to resume their citizenship by taking oath of allegiance. The courts are not in agreement as to whether the oath is necessary before citizenship can be resumed. However, the better view seems to be that it is. And remember, this article was written in 1952, so that question has probably been resolved at this point. In the last section of the article here, it mentions the Nationality Act of 1940, and I'll continue reading here. Today is in 1952. The Nationality Act of 1940 is the law on the subject. It repealed and replaced all the laws on the subject in effect prior to October 1940. Section 727A provides for the resumption of citizenship by naturalization. Naturalization, however, under this section is limited to persons who had lost their citizenship by marriage to aliens prior to September 22, 1922, persons who had lost their citizenship by the spouse's loss of citizenship, and persons who had lost their citizenship by marriage to aliens ineligible to citizenship on or after September 22, 1922. These persons must have been citizens of the United States, and they must not have acquired any other nationality by any affirmative act. They are excused from compliance with some of the requirements of the naturalization laws, the same as under the Act of July 3, 1930. Section 717B provides for the resumption of citizenship by taking the oath of allegiance as prescribed for by Section 735, Subsection B, Title 8 of the United States Code. This privilege is limited to women who were citizens of the United States by birth and who had lost or were believed to have lost their citizenship solely by reason of their marriage to aliens prior to September 22, 1922. The marriages must have been terminated and no other nationality may have been acquired by any affirmative act. In the United States, the oath could be taken before a judge or clerk of a naturalization court or, if abroad, before a diplomatic or consular officer of the United States. However, it is no longer possible for women whose marriages had not been terminated, but who had continuously resided in the United States since their marriages, to resume their citizenship by taking the oath of allegiance. They must now be naturalized under Section 717A of the Act. And there's a brief summary here of this article written in 1952 by Kazuyoshi Akita for the Denver Law Review. The summary reads, "The courts today are not in accord as to the citizenship status of those American women who married aliens prior to 1907. As to those women who married aliens from 1907 to 1922, it is clear that they lost their citizenship by marriages. The same can be said for those women who, between 1922 and 1931, married aliens ineligible to become citizens. Those whose marriages took place after 1931 no longer lost their citizenship by their marriages, and it made no difference whether they married aliens who were eligible or ineligible to become citizens. Thus, today, that is in 1952, American women are free to marry any and all aliens without losing their citizenship. Under Section 717A and B of the Nationality Act of 1940, it is possible for these women who lost their citizenship to regain it either by naturalization or by taking an oath. The way is open also for those women who married prior to 1907 and who are uncertain of their citizenship status. Increased restrictions upon aliens and the danger of some of them being classed as enemy aliens in the event of another war should be incentive enough to make them want to regain their lost citizenship." And that is about as thorough and concise of an account of this chapter of American history as I have been able to find very briefly by doing some Google searches. And this was an issue of great importance to Harriet Harrison, who married an alien in 1914 and lost her citizenship that way. Now, an unanswered question that I have about Aunt Hattie is whether she ever regained her citizenship. The current state of my genealogical research shows that her husband, Herman Polag, who was a baker in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and a German national, applied for citizenship, but I don't have any papers that say that he was ever actually nationalized. He died on the 29th of January, 1927. Harriet lived another 17 years, and I have not yet found any naturalization documents for her. However, in preparation for this podcast, I did discover a Numident Social Security claim for her that took place the day after her death in 1944. So that provides some evidence that Harriet at least attempted to enter the Social Security program, and that suggests that she did at some point regain her American citizenship. And this is a topic that I will likely be delving into a little more in the future, and you may hear an update on a future podcast whether I discovered any more concrete evidence of Harriet's renaturalization after losing her citizenship when she married her husband, Herman Polag, in 1914. And now on to the final interesting fact about Harriet Harrison's life, and this is a tragic one, and it is her end. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported on the 30th of March, 1944, "Woman injured by taxicab. While attempting to cross Broad Street at Chestnut in the rain last night, Mrs. Harriet Polag, 66, of 5143 Girard Avenue, an employee of the Fidelity Philadelphia Trust Company building, was seriously injured when struck by a taxicab. At Pennsylvania Hospital, Mrs. Polag was found to have suffered possible fractures of both legs and arms. John Scanny, 29, of Franklin Street near Wyoming Avenue, driver of the taxicab, according to police, skidded 75 feet in trying to avoid striking the victim." So, Harriet Harrison Polag was injured by a taxicab on the 29th of March in the evening, and then later succumbed to her injuries on the 30th. She and her husband, Herman, are buried in Fernwood Cemetery, just west of Philadelphia. Her occupation was listed as janitress, and in previous years, her occupation was listed as factory girl and forelady. I'd be interested to know what would be the duties of a forelady. And when I was in correspondence with my grandmother's cousin, Doris Doyle, back between 2008 and 2013, she referred to Harriet as Aunt Hattie. So that's how I shall refer to her from now on. She was Doris Doyle's Aunt Hattie, and I also call her Aunt Hattie. A very interesting lady, born a twin, celebrated 21st birthday with friends, associates, and neighbors, was a single mother, later married a foreign national and lost her citizenship, likely regained her citizenship, and then was tragically killed, being struck by a taxi cab at Broad and Chestnut Street in Philadelphia on the 30th of March, 1944, 80 years ago today. And that just about wraps up another episode of Genealogy by Tim. Next month, late April, I shall have more updates on these projects I've been working on. The transcription of Mummas from Mumma.org, the location of the Hogendahler Family Bible, the payment of a $1.09 invoice to the State Archive of Ukraine, and any other interesting things I find, I will share with you next month. Until then, keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits.